I loved it immediately.
Oh,
but
okay.
I also, yeah, I don't know. I just love cigarettes.
Do you remember Chris Schilling?
No, I don't.
I used to, when he was finished his cigarettes, I would take them out of the ashtray and smoke them down to the very nub.
Oh, my God.
That's how I got started, yeah. At the neutral ground.
Wow. That's savagery.
Yeah, it's really gross.
And impressive. Somehow.
Yeah.
You know, I was dedicated to the cause. Once I got a taste, it's like nicotine, and I'm like very weird in that nicotine and alcohol are the best drugs for me possible. Like
yeah.
everything else yeah. pales in comparison, except for like OxyContin or like you know like
right.
something that's just like it's impossible not to have fun.
Mm-hmm.
I love both of them, but my experiment mm-hmm. in moderation persists. I'm still on the wagon. Which is,
oh, good.
And by wagon, I mean I only get drunk 2-3 nights a week instead of eight nights a week. Yeah,
that's good, though.
Yeah.
But when you say drunk, how drunk?
Well, now, like not like falling down drunk by any stretch of the imagination, but like,
yeah.
I mean, I'm one of the reasons why it was so easy for me to drink as much as I was, which was like I was hitting double digits in, you know, twice a week probably. But, like, you know, never blacked out, never got sick, never, like, slurred. I've always been able to hold my liquor. But so it just kind of crept up on me. I wasn't paying attention to it. And I was like, oh, I'm destroying my body for less fun than I would have if I just took a day off
right.
every once in a while.
That's a good point.
So now I'm, like, I'm already tipsy and I've had one drink.
Yeah.
My tolerance has plummeted.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Do you drink?
Yeah, I mean, when I was living here
the
first time,
mm-hmm.
I was drinking way too much. I was working at the Times-Picayune covering crime,
mm-hmm.
and I was 65 pounds heavier than I am now because I was eating my feelings
yeah.
and also drinking my feelings.
Can you close the curtain?
Yeah, if I quit drinking, I'd lose a lot. Well, it's partially the alcohol calories itself and then also how you eat when you're hungover and, yeah.
And drunk.
Yeah, yeah I'm better. The problem with me is that my body has learned to not get hungry after a certain time, because it's like, this is the time where we only drink. So I...
Yeah.
But then the next day I make up for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I definitely... When I was religiously going to the gym and trying to put on weight,
mm-hmm.
If I fell short of my calorie goal mm-hmm. for the day, I would just drink.
Oh, my God. That can't be...
I was going to do it anyway,
right,
but...
Right,
right.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah. No, I do... It's hard because I decided, I was like, maybe I'll do the Michael thing and stop drinking during the week, but I work at a school, so this is my summer.
Hmm.
So maybe I'll be able to do that when I actually have to go to work
yeah.
in the mornings. But now I go to work on the weekend mornings, so because I work part-time at a workout studio, and being hungover there is the worst. So I'm actually practicing more moderation on like Friday and Saturday
yeah,
than
yeah,
I am
yeah.
during the week. Yeah.
You also go to, I mean, like if I did Mike's,
mm-hmm.
on weeknights, there's no way I would stay sober.
Yeah, I try to not drink. If I'm not going to a bar at night, I try to not drink at home. But if I start drinking at a bar and then get home, there's no stopping me. I will drink another bottle of wine.
Yeah.
So you do open mics?
Mm-hmm. We all do comedy.
Yeah.
How many do you do a week about?
I mean, I think...
Or is it a weekly thing?
The two of us, Mary Devin and myself, go up pretty much most nights.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's like an open mic or a book show or something. So
wow.
That's the goal.
Yeah.
But
that's amazing.
I've been slacking a lot this summer because I've been finally taking time to like just be a person, which is really nice. But yeah, I think I'm going to get back to it in the fall.
I literally have not done a show since eating shit at your show.
You gotta just
I know,
do it.
I know. I mean, I'm booked on the Margie thing, so I have to
oh, right.
do some mics. But
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I also just like, yeah, I'm the dilettante of the group for sure.
But if you're going up that often, when do you get time to write your material?
I don't write. I've never written a joke. I mean,
oh, wow.
I honestly mean that. I just kind of like every punchline I've ever gotten was because I started saying something and then I couldn't figure out how to get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, at some point, someone needs to laugh. All right, here we go.
Yeah.
But most of the time I fail. It's not like it's like that easy, but... I don't. It's a bad process. I'm a bad comedian.
It's not true. A lot of people write on stage, and I don't think that's bad. I just think that, like, if you're going to do that, you have to actually treat. Like, you actually have to actually like, listen to your sets and sort of like write out what could be better, which is something I did once, but I don't do anymore. But like, you should record yourself and listen to it and pull out what's good and yada, yada, yada.
I see you scribbling before most sets.
Yeah, but I'm just figuring out what jokes I'm going to do and like tagging them sometimes, but it's nothing. It's not a very high level writing process. Also, whenever I've like written out a shit ton before I go up, those are always like my worst sets. I feel like the more I plan, the worse it is.
Yeah, I mean, that's come up in the context of this.
Is there a comparison with journalism?
Do you like say, I feel
try and write
stories.
Something every day, or
well,
do you like?
I think in general, just in terms of writing things down, people continually tell me I should outline, but I'm just not that type of person to do that. I feel like it takes away from the craft in a lot of ways, even though it doesn't sound like it would. If I really have to do a long story, maybe I'll write down some key points I need to hit, but generally I don't outline. I mean, maybe I should.
You just start at the beginning, keep going.
My process is generally reporting
stories, though. How does that start?
I mean, it depends, because now I'm into the psychedelic beat, so I have a bunch of people who talk to me, a lot of people in the veteran community now, because I just got a grant to go to Peru with these veterans who are doing ayahuasca to deal with their PTSD, something I'm highly interested in. And a lot of those guys are coming to me with different stories, and that type of stuff is how I generate stories now in that realm. But then I have people from covering crime for so many years that come to me with criminal justice stories and things like that. Yeah.
So at a certain point, it just becomes self-sustaining.
I'd like to think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a hustle, though.
No, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. Before we continue, who's our guest?
This is Henrik Carolisson.
Carolisson.
How Carolisson?
Yes, my mom can't even pronounce it. That was good.
You say it.
Carolisson.
Carolisson?
Yeah.
Oh wow, that's so. Yeah, that's good job, Benjamin.
Yeah, I mean, I was on TV once, and the guy beforehand was saying, "How do you say it? How do you say it?" He literally asked me about five times, and when we went live, he just said, "And this is Henrik." You say your last name, and I was like, "Come on, man."
I get comics coming through from other places doing my shows, and I'll do the same thing. I'll ask them like five times what their name is, like where they're from. And then I'll get on stage and I'm about to intro them. And sometimes I'll just intentionally mumble and be like, make some noise. Hey, the next guy.
Yeah.
And that works, I guess, right?
I mean, eventually people are just like, okay.
It's a little bit more casual than the news or wherever you were on TV. Where were you on TV for?
NBC. It was actually some surfing story that I pitched and wrote for the Daily News about hipster surfers dropping in and not knowing the etiquette.
Oh,
cool.
And apparently they're all into this story. I just thought it was funny.
Yeah, that does sound funny.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is like getting away with something. I'm able to go out there, get paid to go to the beach, talk to surfers, and then I'm on TV for it. But
what is the dropping in etiquette?
Oh, well, if someone is on the wave, you can't just go in on the wave
like
some asshole.
Yeah.
But it happens quite often. You'd be surprised, especially in New York City. Out in Rockaway Beach has become a hub of hipsterism and surfing.
I never considered that surfing would occur in New York City because I'm so stupid. And
you're not stupid. No,
instead of the Beach Boys, it's the Velvet Underground.
Yeah.
I saw John Cale out there. No, just kidding. Yeah. I mean, and it was really bizarre that was a thing in New York, and it still is, actually. Post Sandy, that hurricane that came through. Mm-hmm. All these hip, they call them trustafarian kids with their parents' money, come in, they buy a place, and then they try to surf and they get worked when the waves are good.
Yeah.
But the rest of the time they try to go out there and they don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
It's comical unless you're actually surfing and some asshole's in your way. And you're like,
yeah, it does
on,
seem
man.
Like there's like a pretty big barrier to entry because you have to suck at the same place that other people are like actually surfing at.
Yeah.
You're just fucking in their way.
That was my skate park experience. I was like, I cannot be publicly bad at stuff. That's when I learned.
I feel this way about video games. Every time I try and play a video game, it's with someone who plays video games. And I'm like, this isn't even fun.
Yeah.
I don't know the buttons and you're like shooting people. I can't do this shit.
What kind of video games?
I mean, I don't really play, mostly for this reason, because, like, for the past, like, 15 years, I haven't, like, owned a console or anything, so anytime I, like, end up with someone who's playing, they're, like, they know what they're doing, I'm like, I'll just fucking hang out and smoke weed over here.
Did you, Benjamin, like, surf at all when you were, like, on mushrooms and naked for five straight years in Hawaii or whatever?
No, I didn't... I didn't really have enough money to buy a surfboard or enough money to like take lessons, which is kind of the way you do it if you can't buy one or if no one's gonna like loan you a surfboard.
Yeah.
Yeah. Had I stayed out there any longer, I probably would have.
What part of Hawaii were you in?
I was on the Big Island in Puna.
Yeah.
Yeah, I imagine if you're working the ayahuasca beat, you've probably encountered some like insane shaman freaks from that like part of the world. I was there for like a year and a half once, and then for like 3 months once.
Wow.
Something like that.
Just surfing every day?
No, I was working on a farm, kind of. It was like the first time I went out there, it was through WOOF, like Worldwide Opportunities on Organic Farms, and then the second time I went out there, it was basically the same deal, but not like through WOOF. I had just met some people and I went back because Minnesota was rough.
We talked about those winters before.
Yeah, exactly. I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
I love winter.
But yeah, so you worked for New York Daily News.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was there for 5 years, just covering all sorts of things. And I started general assignment. And then I started getting interviews at Rikers Island. So they put me on that beat. And then I just started covering crime and whatever big was happening. And that was at a time when I sound like an old man. Back in my day, they used to send people around the country. And but they did. I mean, they'd send me all over the place if something was going on. And yeah, so I was there for 5 years. Then I came down here to work at the Times-Picayune. But I mean, I don't want to get into that sort of thing. But it wasn't a good situation. So I ended up leaving there, freelancing for a little while, and then going back to New York to work at the Wall Street Journal to cover crime again. And then I left there to freelance. And now I'm back here again.
I mean, it seems like that's kind of the story for journalists at this point, is just like, if you're a journalist, you're a freelance journalist.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, because you have to, you don't have to make as many concessions. You can write about the things you want to. And after a while, if you've been in it for long enough, you have sources and you have people who rely on you and you have people who trust you and you have enough clients to kind of make it work. But it's still, like I said before, it's a hustle and you have to really love it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I do see a lot of kids who are inexperienced who are just becoming staff writers at these newspapers, and it's unbelievable. I mean, they're not getting paid, and they're not...
You mean they're not getting paid at all, or they're not getting paid?
No, no, they're not getting paid well.
They're not, right, yeah.
And I think that that's obviously why. It's an economic thing, but it changes the dynamic of the stories people are covering and what they're reading and how they associate with them, which is kind of sad. But then again, I sound like a dinosaur when I say those types of things.
No.
So there might be some good to it.
What's the path of... What's the path of being able to be a an effective journalist that's actually able to cut? Like, it, obviously, you can't just start off as a freelancer, right? Because you're going to have to build up some sort of like reputation for yourself. So, other than becoming a staff writer, what should people do?
Well, I think like we were talking about before, I think freelancing is a good way, but you have to start at sort of low level places and kind of work your way in.
What are the sort of stories that you think have been like inflection points in your career?
I think the Sandy Hook mass shooting in Connecticut was one that really affected me to a point where I thought I was going to leave journalism because I was just devastated every single day that I was covering the story. Because initially they thought it was a fake alert that went over the wire, which happens every now and then. Because it was this affluent Connecticut town, and they said 20 kids are dead, 6 teachers are dead. Just go up there and see. We don't think this is real, but as soon as I went up there, I mean, the whole town was shut down. And I covered it from the beginning to the end to the last funeral. And by the end of it, I was in tears at the last funeral. It was just draining. And that was the point, the inflection point, where I just thought, maybe this isn't for me. That's the one I always go back to. But I was thinking about leaving, but then I started doing different types of stories that kept me involved. Right after that, I actually ended up interviewing DMC from Run DMC. And I'm a huge hip-hop fan. I grew up in New York and Queens, and he was obviously influential just in terms of, you know, the aesthetic, in terms of the music, in terms of everything I enjoyed as a kid in the 90s. He was one of those people. It's like him, Rakim.
How'd that happen?
Well, I might have just pitched a story about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame that was kind of far-fetched, but I just said that he's from Queens, and I want to write a Queens-based story. And it was, they were like, well, if you can get him on the phone, then we'll give you the story. And I ended up reaching out to his people, and he got back to me amazingly. And it was one of the best interviews I've ever had, actually. And that's what kept me involved in journalism.
Damn, I wish I'd read that.
How, like, How many times have you pitched a story on vaporware and then like figured out how to get it done after you got commissioned or whatever?
I think it's pretty much 95% of the time, to be honest with you, because just passion. I mean, it's just, if I'm really interested in it, I think I'll just make it happen. Mm-hmm. Not to sound hokey or laws of attraction type of bullshit, but I do think if you really care about something, you'll figure out a way. If you mm-hmm. If you make it more of a have to thing as opposed, and I need that because mm-hmm. I sort of need a deadline. Because otherwise, I'm just going to try to perfect something, perfect the pitch, perfect the type of story, and it'll never happen.
Right. What's vaporware?
Oh, I just meant like basically misrepresenting the, not misrepresenting, like kind of being, omitting the fact that you haven't actually talked to anyone yet.
Oh, you know okay. What I mean? Oh, yeah. So you know that, okay, so you have to.
Like, because I have a essay that I want to write that would require getting in touch with people, and I would love, and I think I'm just going to pitch it and then figure it out later.
Yeah.
I mean, this is kind of like
a good idea.
It's kind of like a circular, it's kind of a circular thing where like, people don't want to talk to you unless you have an institution that you can cite as the person you're writing for, but nobody wants to give you a story until you, can say like, oh, like this guy wants to talk, you know what I mean? Does that sound right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a strange line to kind of walk, mm-hmm. but.
But at least you have a lot of credit. I mean, you can show people your portfolio and be like, okay, I'm a real person.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't have that.
For good or ill.
Yeah.
I mean, you do.
Yeah, not for like essay writing or journalism or anything like that.
But what's the essay about? Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just saying, that's exactly my approach to like organizing like with DSA stuff is like, I'll just try and convince people that there's a good idea, even if we have absolutely no way to accomplish it mm-hmm. yet. And then I'm like, okay. We have this goal.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have to do it. We told people we're going to do it. Now we have to fucking figure out how to do this shit, which is probably a strength and a weakness of me as an organizer, but it's the only way.
Has it ever backfired on you?
I only know how to corner myself into things and then fight my way.
I mean, that's how you write. That's how you write
stand-up. To say exactly the same thing. Yeah. Once you put yourself in the box, you have to get out of it.
Yeah.
I'm constantly doing that.
To answer your question, the story is just like about sort of the commodification of like of getting away from distraction. So like there's all this like distraction free software or like little typewriters that are only like little word processors that are only word processors.
Who knows?
You know what I mean?
On Instagram,
yeah.
They're trying to grab me for $600.
Yeah, exactly. So I was basically just like, wouldn't it be nice to pitch this story about like that is critical of this hardware just so I could get some free hardware.
That's what I'm talking about. That's some good synergy right there.
All right. I guess I've found out about you through the MDMA piece. Do you want to just let people know like generally what that was and we can talk about how you got into it?
Yeah, well, the story revolves around a woman named Lori Tipton, who I met at a psychedelics conference in Arizona, and she was telling me that she went through all sorts of trauma and tried everything known to man to try to help deal with her PTSD, and the only thing that worked for her was MDMA-assisted psychotherapy. Mm-hmm. And there have been, around the country, actually, MAPS, I'm trying to remember, the Multidisciplinary
Association for Psychedelics.
I don't know why I'm not remembering. I've been into Rick Doblin and what they do
they like definitely caught my eye that piece.
Right. I don't know why I went blank on that, but they've been doing a lot of good work in terms of advocating for MDMA and they've had these trials, clinical trials throughout the country with people like her who are seeing these effects that take hold, that they're feeling much better because they take the MDMA with two psychotherapists, and it's about an 8-week treatment. And based on the results, it seems like it might be legalized within the next 2 years, is what they're saying.
Legalized for specifically trauma therapy.
PTSD.
Yeah, PTSD. Mm-hmm. How did, I want to talk more about the important stuff, but how did you get, why was Tucker Max in it?
just randomly, I was doing some research and I saw an essay that he wrote, and I just randomly reached out to him and thought it would be funny if he.
Yeah, that's amazing. Wait, was his trauma like Did it help him realize that he was an asshole?
I didn't read his books.
Okay, I did. I went to LSU, and like that book was very popular my freshman year.
Yeah.
And I ended up just reading it on various toilets in various dorms because every boy had it.
I read his like his
and
like,
some girls had it ironically.
His like pre YouTube website. Do you know what?
Oh yeah, I remember that blog.
What was it called? Like the fucking awesome. He like the origin of like the cool like cool people being called ninjas. That's where that shit came from.
Oh, I hate that.
Yeah, it's horrible.
Yeah. No,
I mean,
really,
I think he probably had like a very like high and horrible influence on culture. Like,
yeah.
I mean, all of those essays.
Antithesis is what I'm all about. Just as a sensitive man, I'm just like, that's not the person I would. But I just randomly was able to get him to tell me a few things, and I just thought people would be like, okay, that's random.
It was amazing to see Tucker Max just say the word empathy at all.
Exactly.
Like, yeah, I mean, I just wouldn't and like talk about trauma. I mean, you would think that someone like that would just be like, trauma's for, you know,
pussies.
Yeah,
well,
exactly.
I mean, like something that we were talking about on the last episode is that is the idea that like maybe people are a product of their context, and I think that extends also to like internet sociopaths.
Well, yeah, I think that Tucker Max, so I mean, true. I was, when I read it, I was like, oh, wait, maybe he realized that like he was acting this way towards women because something terrible happened to him or something like that. I would love to know more about his therapy.
I feel like that was this sort of narrative arc of his.
I'm going to read that essay. Yeah. Okay.
I really think that go ahead.
No, because he's been writing about it on his blog for a long time. He's like, he quote liberally from it, changed my life. I see things differently. It seems like he does have empathy now at age 42.
Yeah. He's an angel investor now, I saw.
Yeah.
So there's it's different from
what is that?
He made a lot of money on his Tard blog.
It's someone who
which is what it was called.
I don't really understand, but I think it's someone who invests in like ideological things. I know when what is it?
I mean, it's basically people who take to make really high risk investments with a lot of money.
Oh, okay.
So like people like the first round of funding for like a startup is a lot of angel investors.
Okay. Okay. So it's just venture capital.
I'll look that up.
I used to work for a company that failed, and we were always seeking out angel investors, and then we got old enough and bad enough that eventually the boss was like, okay, we're too old, we have to quit the company.
We can't call ourselves a startup anymore.
Yeah, we're not a startup anymore, we're 7 years old.
You're still it was the business equivalent of like still shopping at Forever 21.
Right, it was really terrible, but she was a very awesome cool lady that everyone wanted to help, but her company sucked. And anyway,
was that in New Orleans?
Yeah. We'll talk after. Right. You'll probably know
off
her.
The record.
Yeah. Okay, she's a nice person.
I guess if you want to just go a little bit over like what this therapy is, how people get it, how you ended it. Yeah.
Yeah. If you go to clinicaltrials.gov, you can see if you're capable to get it. You can get it in New Orleans. There's 14 other places around the country you can get it. You just sign up to the website, and you have to get a psychiatrist to sign off on it. And once you do that, you might get a chance to be in the trials, but not everyone can be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There are certain parameters around that.
I actually looked into it because I've been diagnosed with a PTSD adjacent thing. And, but it involves, it's basically like, it seems like these trials basically use MDMA as like emotional anesthesia, where it's like, it's like getting like, it's like cognitive behavioral therapy for PTSD havers is like extremely painful. And so MDMA allows them to interact with the thoughts and ideas associated with it without abject pain. Right.
Does that sound right?
And it helps you remember what actually happened, which I thought was so interesting because I've never used MDMA as a positive. but I do think like it made me
go on.
No, I mean I've done ecstasy and more pure forms of ecstasy. Like I've done a lot of drugs, and I've like used MDMA, but when they said it like elevated the prefrontal cortex, which helps with memory, I was like, I wish I had at any point just tried to think of one thing to see if I remembered it any better.
Right. I mean, this is why I'm talking way outside my lane, but I think this is why it's not like MDMA cures PTSD. It's like MDMA with hella therapy.
Right. You can actually address the things that you just keep down because you're able to.
Yeah.
And that's amazing.
But to just finish the thought, like, sorry. I like, no, it's okay. I just like, don't have any, I don't have like a single traumatic memory to recall. Mm-hmm. So it like doesn't seem like it would make any fucking sense for me to participate.
But well, you're interested in doing it?
Yeah, absolutely.
I know there's, so from what I've heard, like I've heard Rick Doblin on podcasts before. I've like read some stuff about MAPS, but it seems like it's not necessarily the chemical, but it's the experience you have. And I think there's like a similar thing with treating like mushrooms treating depression, mm-hmm. or at least psilocybin, because I think a lot of the time they can't actually use mushrooms, they have to use like psilocybin extract. Mm-hmm. But they've shown that it's the experience itself that's actually doing any of the changing and not the chemical compound. Do you want to correct me if I'm wrong? No,
that's absolutely right. Based on everything I've read and researched about it, there's what they call set and setting, mm-hmm. where it's basically the context under which you take any of these substances, and that can change your whole experience with it. And if you have someone who's a psychotherapist guiding you through these things, it could be way more effective, obviously, than just doing MDMA or psilocybin by yourself in a room without any context.
Right, or just with your friends or whatever.
With your friends or just as a party thing, or without this sort of consciousness where you're looking to heal or looking to change things within your trauma or anything like that. I'm doing a story that's coming out in the Gambit about kratom. I'm not sure if you heard about it.
Oh, yeah.
Well, there's...
basically any psychotropic that we can make any excuse about taking for the good of our soul, we know about it.
Amen. So I'm doing a story about that because it's there was a bill that quietly passed last month that would outlaw it if it becomes a Schedule I drug, and the DEA has tried to do that before. So,
and people use it to as methadone, right?
Yeah, they use it to heal. They use it also for, it's really good for withdrawal mm-hmm. symptoms. So I've been talking to a lot of people who've been getting off of opioids with the help of kratom. And it's become popular in New Orleans in the past 2 years. Mm-hmm. You know, the mushroom,
Euphorbia,
Calvar. Yeah, I mean, I've tried it. And
it didn't really do anything to me.
That was the same thing with me. Yeah. I think I drank it too slowly. I was warned that it might be bad for my stomach, so she said drink it slowly.
It made me feel kind of bad, but it didn't really do anything to me. Yeah.
No. Yeah. But I mean, if people use it to heal, I think it should be banned. So, I think it shouldn't be, you know, randomly administered and chemically induced with other stuff, because there are stats that the FDA put out that there were 44 deaths involving kratom, but only one that was pure kratom, and the rest were, you know, fentanyl, heroin, codeine, and other things.
Doing the heavy lifting there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that also it's like you have to be careful about narratives about stuff like kratom, because it like really helps a lot of people. But also, I know a lot of people who really struggle to get off of it.
Yeah.
And like, and basically, it shouldn't be like, if it's addictive, then it should be illegal.
Of course.
Do you know what I mean?
But the public image of it shouldn't be like marijuana. Like, there are certain things that, I mean,
you mean the devil's lettuce?
I think all of us don't think anything should be illegal.
Right. Yeah.
But, and like the whole legislation around drugs is obviously deeply problematic. But so I definitely think that. Yeah, I agree that kratom or kratom, it's kratom, I don't know.
Kratom.
but I agree that it shouldn't be taken lightly, but it also shouldn't be illegal. But people should have all the information about it and make educated decisions before they use it. But
how long have you been covering the psychedelic beat?
About 2 years.
Okay, so the sort of the clinical trials about like mitigating fear of death in terminally ill patients with psilocybin, that was before you started covering it?
Yeah.
What do you have any information about like the state of that research right now?
As far as I know, it's ongoing.
Yeah. It's like fucking crazy. I'm going to actually look it up, because it was like a long form New York Times Magazine piece, which whatever, but like, sorry. Like something at least 2/3 of, so basically like they like had people trip on mushrooms or trip on psilocybin specifically, like in their bed, like with a clinician by them, like just like a very comfortable surroundings. They were like invited to close their eyes or whatever. And they tripped, and they were all terminally ill, and they were all like dreading being dead, because who among us?
Yeah.
and like the number is insane. I don't remember specifically. I would say conservatively, 2/3 of them said it was the most important experience of their lives, and like something like 92% said it was like top three.
Wow.
Yeah, it's like I'm gonna look it up, but it's fucking nuts. Yeah,
it's profound.
It made me want to do all the mushrooms because I may not be terminally ill, but I mean we're all terminally ill in a way, man.
Yeah, we're all dying.
Going to the same place.
Yeah.
Have you read the Michael Pollan book?
No, it's on my list. Yeah, I'm like. I was going to ask you, have you read The Body Keeps the Score? Because they talk a little bit about the MDMA stuff there.
Yeah. No, it's a big book, too.
That book rules. If you feel bad ever, you should read it just to see if it resonates.
Say it again?
Yeah. The Body Keeps the Score. Yeah. It's like Wilhelm Van Fredrickson. It's just like he's got a role. You might know his name. I'll look it up.
I know his name, man. But yeah, I read it a while ago. It's legit.
So what drew you to this beat?
Well, I was actually working with a photographer I knew from the Daily News back in the day, and he was telling me about a story about toad venom. I don't know if you guys have heard about that, but people are smoking toad venom to ostensibly also do the same thing I was talking about with MDMA and psilocybin.
I mean, this is kind of like licking toads. Like
it's secreted from toads, it's dried, and then it's smoked in a shamanic setting, that sort of thing. But I went with him down to Kentucky to profile a guy who sort of became a rogue shaman who was administering the toad venom to people he knew. And that, to me, was an interesting story. So, and that's an ongoing story. I've been working on this thing for almost 2 years, and that's what drew me to the beat, more or less. And also, since I've been covering crime for so long, it was interesting to be covering the polar opposite. To be covering healing.
Right, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that was like more that psychological, I felt like. Yeah, for me anyway.
Yeah.
I always knew frogs were down.
Yeah. And there's also Cambo. There's a guy I know. I don't want to talk too much about it, but yeah, he administers, I'm trying to remember what it is. It also comes from a frog, and it's something to the effect that it's drained from the frog, and it's dipped into you, and then you just start purging, and it's no
ayahuasca
psychoactive, but there's no psychoactive element, so it's not like ayahuasca. You just
throw up,
barf a lot,
and you could also get inflamed in the face and everything.
Oh, it sounds fun.
I don't know enough about it, but I definitely want to.
Sounds like
that
me now. On a Saturday morning. You know what I'm saying?
Not really, but go on.
Hungover with the frog, man.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, so there's just so much going on in the beat, and I feel like once you go down the rabbit hole, you could stay there for a long time, covering interesting people, interesting things, and
just to cite my sources real quick. 92% of participants in the psilocybin study said it was one of the top five most meaningful experiences of their lives, and 34% said it was number one.
Well, 68. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Go.
No, that was referenced in the Michael Pollan book.
Yeah,
you'll love it, man. You got to read it.
68% of people in the MAP study said it improved. I wonder about the other 30%.
I was interested about that too.
Yeah, I wonder if it was like, I wonder if it made it worse or if they were just like, still bad. But I would be interested to know about that. But I would think that MDMA, if it's like super with a psychiatrist who knows what they're doing and administered, the amount is like administered in a very scientific way, I doubt that it could make it worse except for the general effects of MDMA. I really want to ask Lori Tipton, did it make you feel shitty the next day? Because, like, every time I do, I mean, obviously the amounts are different. I've just, done Molly a bunch. And the next day, doing pure Molly is always better than when I did ecstasy in college. Because whenever I did ecstasy, I'd want to kill myself for 2 weeks because it's horrific.
2 weeks? By ecstasy, you mean something adulterated with something other than...
The pills that are in this, like, things that looked like this.
Yeah. I mean, and you were also, I assume, drinking and staying up all night.
Honestly, in college, the reason we did ecstasy is because we couldn't get booze. Alcohol.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the reasons we would be like, all right, because I had a fake ID for most of it, but some places wouldn't take my fake ID. And I was, that's why I had literally any friends.
Juice doesn't card.
Right. If I was a virgin with no fake ID, no one would have talked to me. But I, but anyway, so I... We got ecstasy because we just found predatory men who found a bunch of 18-year-old girls and were like, oh, crazy. Mm-hmm. I have this ecstasy for you. Yeah. I'll give it to you at my apartment.
Yeah.
And most of the time it was generally safe, but that guy ended up going to jail for a long time. The guy that sold us our ecstasy and ended up stealing a lot of our stuff got arrested. But
for stealing your stuff?
Tigers,
no,
baby.
For after we were long out of college and he had done some messed up stuff to his very cool girlfriend, who is how I met him. That's how we all knew him, because he had a very cool girlfriend that, you know, had no confidence. This is too much.
This is also off topic, but have I told you guys the story of the guy I went to high school with who murdered both of his parents?
No.
So I'll keep it short. But long story short, this flip-flop wearing, plaid shorts donning, just mild-mannered kid, for some reason killed both of his parents and then tried to dissolve them in acid.
Oh, like, God.
Like Breaking Bad style. Oh, and God. Failed miserably. And yeah, so.
And you went to high school with him?
And I went to high school
with him. What does that have to do with anything?
Oh, bad people that you know who thoughts. Got arrested?
Yeah.
Oh. How long after you went to high school with him did he do that?
I would say 7 years.
Okay,
like that.
Jesus Christ.
Wow.
Anyway,
I would say allegedly,
short,
but he did it.
What's on topic?
Is that on Dateline?
I wouldn't be surprised.
That's a big one.
Yeah.
What's on
Man,
topic
I feel like you
this.
Really got to know you're going to dissolve a body before you try.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not trial and error.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, it's like, not like steaming a shirt in the shower.
Do your research. He probably got the idea from Breaking Bad where it didn't There's work. No, like,
yeah, it's one of those things where like...
Trust it. I can do
confidence
it.
can backfire. It's like, I could probably pull this off.
Wow.
Yeah.
But anyway, no, those drugs, that ecstasy made me feel so bad. And then a few years later, I did real MDMA, and I was like, I feel a little bit bad, but in an incredibly manageable way.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
But
yeah.
My question is to you, if you felt terrible and then moderately bad, why do you keep doing it? Were you looking for something else?
Oh, because
else
it was so great. I mean, because I only do it occasionally. Like, I'll probably do it, like, once a year now. And it's always worth the kind of hangover the next day.
Okay.
Because when I say I feel really bad, I just mean, like, songs aren't as good. I don't know what I want to eat. And then, like, I wake up the next day and I'm okay. But, like, it used to be deeply depressed. And I think the reason I kept doing it back then was that I was depressed from that and other drugs. And also just taking terrible care of myself because I was really young.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think set and setting is like very important with all this, and like where I've done a lot of psychedelics and MDMA and absolutely think that it's had a measurably positive influence on my life. I was a very fucking angry teenager who probably would have ended up doing like poorly thought out political bombings had I not like kind of
bombs,
like,
not food.
Benjamin went to an alternative school for high school. Yeah.
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 Because I got kicked out because I was so angry. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, and then, yeah, sort of like found psychedelics and through psychedelics found, you know, pseudo Buddhist bullshit that has like, helped my life a lot. But
yeah. If it works, it's not pseudo.
Yeah.
But so whatever works, here's my question, because this is relevant to the MDMA thing. Like, do you think it was the substances themselves, or do you think it was the conversations you had on those substances? Because I imagine that you had some intense conversations on like Molly and mushrooms and stuff.
I mean, I think
because it's
both. I mean,
that is that issue in
that's
this
the thing
particular
about it is like these,
phenomenon.
And I'm this is just my opinion, man. But like, I think these chemicals do have like transformative potential, and I think that's one of the reasons they're regulated is because they can absolutely change the way people operate.
Right. There's
fundamental, like, you can have a fundamentally different view of yourself and society because of the experiences you have on them, but they are the catalyst.
I feel about Timothy Leary the way I also feel about the Soviet Union, which is that a lot of whack shit went down, but also a lot of people were very, very interested in making sure he seemed as fucking crazy as possible. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
like, I mean, I'm sure he had a file.
Not just a file. I mean, he was, like, one of the FBI's, like, number one enemies.
Yeah.
For a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, him, Abby Hoffman. I mean, they saw that what they were doing had a political element to it and, you know, tried to control it that way.
Yeah, and they were like, but what if we made a bomb that made everybody gay? just like doing a lot of cool experiments.
I mean, and it's, you know, pretty, like, people have pointed this out but they threw all drugs into that as a way to like stop the political element of it, and also then they could like jail minorities and poor people. So
yeah, the war on drugs is one of the most disgusting travesties of this country.
Dude, I just learned about, like, this is like a meme on left internet that I didn't know about. Have you heard about the adrenochrome thing? So basically,
wait, the conspiracy about like eating babies?
Yeah, like the satanic ritual abuse shit.
Wait, is this Alex Jones stuff?
I think that probably, I mean,
it gets into like Jeffrey Epstein and QAnon and all that shit.
But basically, it's like this very interesting, like pseudo scientific rationalization for the belief that like Democrats ritually abuse children, which is that like they're extracting the specific compound that is made from oxidized adrenaline, so they have to like put the fear of God into someone in order to farm out this material. It's fucking hilarious.
Sounds like shit.
Yeah.
Is that in the New York Times? Or?
Oh yeah. Wait, this makes me want to go into the warrior gene that is real, that you talked about in your predictive policing article.
That was
insane. That article somehow was, I mean, I don't know why I'm surprised by this, but it was way more insane than the MDMA stuff.
Let me read an excerpt for to give the listener context. Let me see. I probably should have found it before I interrupted you.
Here. I think I highlighted things.
I mean, just to give some people background on your predictive policing.
Okay, I got it. Okay. Go ahead.
Oh, article. This is basically people or police forces trying to Philip K. Dick.
Yeah.
I mean, crime, right?
Yeah, they're ostensibly looking at algorithms to pinpoint where crimes happen, to dictate where they're happening in the future. And, you know, it's been happening. I wrote that article about 5 years ago, and it's only increased since. I mean, it's happening everywhere, especially in places like LA and New York, and also, you know, around the world. And, it's kind of scary to think about when you think your license plate could be linked up to any of that thing. Because, I mean, these things are still sort of amorphous, and people don't know what to do with them just yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the fact that it can be used to get certain people out of...
Because the listener has no context. So basically, there is a gene that has implications about the way your brain breaks down neurotransmitters. Mm-hmm. Probably norepinephrine. Do you know? Yeah, so it's like also known as noradrenaline, right? So it's basically like some people have a gene that fails to break down... I don't know if it's an... It's not an adrenaline precursor, but like some adrenaline-associated neurotransmitter, right? And so they call that the warrior gene, as in like STAB, not like as in Woody Allen, right? Mm-hmm. And so people are using, like lawyers are using that as a defense for violent crime. And like, you know, like people are having life sentences transmuted to 20 years because they have this gene or like that sort of thing. Which is not, you know, I'm down with reducing people's sentences
just
in general.
It feels like it's, but it, yeah.
But it's like, I mean, like there's all these implications about like, you know, Minority Report was the analogy that you used in the article. You know, you're walking down the street and like, you know, some futuristic brain scanner is like, oh, this person has this, or futuristic DNA scanner is like, this person has this gene, so like, let me follow them or whatever. And also like, so much criminal legal associated science turns out to be bullshit.
Right. But also just like the idea of like
racist.
But the idea that like, okay, so the article's about, I mean, it's 5 years old, and I wanted to ask you some more like conceptual things about writing the article, but some of the things that stuck out to me immediately were, if you see a suspicious car, they had the example, or you had the example of like, you run their plates and you find out they're a known child molester or something. So you're like, okay, well, in that situation, obviously that's not one of the egregious situations where this is like particularly bad. But if you run their plates and you find out, oh, this person, like, you're going to find out, oh, this person has a warrant out for a suspended license, and then you're going to go arrest that person. So it's just a way of like, yeah, it's just...
That's what bothers me, is not the predicting of the crimes that are going to happen, specifically when it comes to... I mean, obviously that bothers me because it's bad, but...
Or it just has horrible implications for...
It has horrible implications, yeah. But, like, the real crux of the issue is that if you are predicting crime, you're going to be just randomly researching plates of people and being like, I bet they're going to do this other thing that we weren't even looking into, and then go get them. Yeah.
And that really reminded me of... because I'm from New York, and I was in New York, actually... right after I wrote this article, I went to New York, and they're still getting over the stop and frisk thing, where mm-hmm. it's the same thing.
Yeah.
Where innocent people are being frisked, and then all of a sudden,
right.
there's some marijuana in their pocket, and all of a sudden they become criminals.
Right.
Go ahead.
The Michael Isaac Stein thing.
Yeah.
The guy who is back in jail because he was out of jail and did not violate his parole, but they filmed him with one of the surveillance cameras.
Yeah.
And
here in New Orleans.
In New Orleans. Yeah. And they thought he was doing a drug deal. So they searched him. They found out he was not doing a drug deal. But they did find a weapon, which was brass knuckles. So right. he's back in prison.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For how long?
I don't know. Whatever violating the parole is.
A couple years, yeah. at least. Yeah. He's got and kids, then, too.
Yeah. It's extremely fucked up. But
the thing that and you touched on this a little bit in one of your articles, but the thing that is hilarious to me about predictive policing is that, like, we have all this technology to like do statistical analysis of where crimes are happening and where crimes are likely to occur, which obviously has extremely racist implications. But even if it worked, like the fact that no one is like, what if we put resources towards
what if we got rid
helping
of
those communities?
It's unbelievable.
Yeah. Like it's just, I mean, it's
no,
like
we're gonna build it's like the police robots instead.
Right. It's like a Band-Aid made of fucking acid.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it seems like the problem is twofold. It's that there is already a corrupt system, and the people that are going to be given more power are operating within a corrupt system that's just going to double down on that power. And then the second problem with it is it's got a completely deterministic view on what people are and what people are capable of, which is pretty antithetical to even the idea of healing.
Or, I mean, yeah, it's also antithetical to the stuff, it's also antithetical to the idea of punishment. Like the idea that like some people have, like that we all have free will and we're like choosing, we're like making these decisions independent of any context. I mean, we were talking about this on the last episode. Like the fact that they think that they can have some sort of deterministic understanding of when crime is going to happen should mean that they have enough context to know that that people who are committing crimes are doing it for all these sort of historical, sociological reasons. And like the fact that the conclusion they're coming to is like, we gotta watch that corner so we can arrest and maybe shoot some people. It's just like fucking insane.
I mean, and there's an observer effect too, where it's like, I mean, all of this is shaping how people act mm-hmm. as well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really good point. I mean, if you know there's predictive policing around you, you might just act... you might act in a way that seems shady, even though you're not doing anything wrong.
Oh, my God. Whenever there's a fucking cop behind me on the goddamn interstate, and I'm, like, so white, and I have all the markers of someone who would not get fucking profiled, and yet, when there's a cop behind me, I drive like I'm wasted.
Yeah, same here. Yeah. And I... am sometimes, not off alcohol, but I have gotten a DUI, so I don't drive drunk anymore, but I still have the 18-year-old mentality. I didn't drive till I was 22, but I still have the mentality of like, weed's fine. And so sometimes, one time I was driving back from Baton Rouge, and I ate part of a pot cookie, did not know how much it had in it.
Oh man, and, that is ballsy.
And I ate part of a pot cookie, so I went 45 miles an hour the entire time because there was a cop car that was literally a mile behind me, but I kept thinking it was getting closer, and I was like, now, and then the fact that it never passed me because it was just so far behind me, I was like, no, they're watching me.
Dude, when me and Jeff were in Atlanta, we were coming back from a show.
Oh, Jeff is the worst about it.
Super late. And we, like, were not at all fucked up. And there was no drugs in the car, which is remarkable for that trip. But, so, we
y'all
were,
did do drugs there, though. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. So, but like
you had run out of drugs. Go on.
We had run out of drugs and we had stopped drinking hours ago. And we were, I mean, like, totally fine and a block away from the place we were staying. and Jeff saw a police car like up ahead and decided instead of driving just past the cop car, who was just like sitting there already with its lights on, which means that it was doing something.
Right, it was busy.
Yeah,
right.
It was busy.
It was ready.
Instead of just driving past it, he took a 7-hour detour into a fucking
neighborhood
a college campus, and then was just driving around the campus, which is like, this is shadier than if you would have just fucking
this is my fiance. He is so afraid of drugs. He's always afraid because I always have drugs in my car, and he's so afraid of it all the time, and he's very mad at me when I accidentally leave my pot in his car. But I'm just a pothead. I don't have like crazy drugs in there. Although one time I lost cocaine in my car and found it when I was cleaning out my car in front of my mom. And I was like, damn, this could have been the police.
When I was like 14, I went to Voodoo Fest with, again, Chris Schilling, same guy whose cigarettes I smoked. The next day he called, or actually at like midnight, he called me and he was like, hey, I can't find my pipe. And my mom had given us a ride home. So I woke up at midnight and I was like, I like went and searched the car and I searched under all the seats or whatever. And then my mom woke up because I was acting like a fucking maniac. And she was like, what's up? And I was like, Mom, there may be
a marijuana
paraphernalia in your Crown Victoria. And she helped me look for it. I mean, she was a nurse at the time, and she was like, you know, it's the kind of thing you can lose your license over or whatever.
Yeah. Wow. It was really good that you told her. You're a good son.
She was mad chill, but I mean, my mom's cool as fuck. Yeah. Like, she doesn't do any drugs, but she's cool.
Yeah. If we actually like would have gotten like stopped and questioned by a hostile cop in that situation, I feel like Jeff would have been so nervous and I would have been so annoyed at Jeff for being nervous that the cop would have just assumed I was kidnapping him.
Right. No, Jeff and I got pulled over and he was sober, but I was fucking loaded, but I was not driving. And we got pulled over and I had to pee so bad. So I was so drunk, I was just mad because I had to pee. Yeah. But we got pulled over because he sort of ran a red light, but it was one of those red lights where it was, okay, so it was at the turn, you know where St. Bernard and Gentilly Boulevard, and, okay, you know that turn, how when
there's
you're
like seven streets.
Yeah, so when you're
there
in the middle, if you want to get out of the way, you have to run a red light. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So he did that, and then it was this super young cop who was 20 years old. I found him on Facebook. He must have been 23 at the oldest, but I like looked him up on Facebook because I was like, this kid is 9 years old. And turns out he was very young.
Yeah.
And
he was 10.
He was 10 years old. And so he pulled us over and he felt more afraid of us than we did of him. And I was like, we're going to be fine. But Jeff was still really shaky and nervous, but he did okay. Because
cops are like bears, but with guns and racist.
Right. But being a white person always helps. But yeah.
Yeah, I get so anxious that like looking at my face would be probable cause to turn the car upside down searching for PCP.
Really?
Oh yeah, I get rolling. I mean, I've never been pulled over, but like just the way I interact with cops on the road, it's just like,
I'm so good with cops. I am a white lady from uptown, so I'm always officer, oh my god, I'm so sorry.
I'm a little sorry. I'm not, you can't see any tears, but I'm crying. And so
no, I'm not really like that, but I'm not hostile to cops when they pull me over.
That could not sound any less like you, and yet I want to use it to do impressions of you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not like that, but I've definitely done the whole like, I don't know. I mean, I don't get pulled over that much, but I got pulled over right after I got a DUI, and I was wearing just a bra and a see-through shirt, and the cop that had given me a DUI pulled me over.
No.
Come on.
Fucking way,
fucking
dude.
Kidding.
Where
it
were you?
It was a checkpoint. And I was sober because I had just gotten a DUI, but he was like, you're not supposed to have a license. I was like, I have a work. I was like, it's 6 p.m. I'm leaving work. I have a work release paper right here. And I was like, here's my ID. They told me I could drive with this. He was like, well, and then he like pat me down and everything because he was a fucking dick. But
A pervert.
Yeah, maybe
a stalker.
Yeah, but anyway, but I was fine. But that was the only time with a cop that I've been actively pissed off. Oh, and another time, wait, another time I did nothing. I'd never gotten a DUI. I'd only gotten arrested for pot.
Wait, can you run that back and say can you just say, oh, and another time.
And another time.
No, you got, because I have to edit out the part where you scream into the microphone.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, you're good. No, keep going.
Oh, and another time.
Yeah, there you go.
I was leaving Mojo and I'd done nothing against the law. Really, at that time in my life that I'd gotten caught for. And I, my car was the same description as another car that had been involved in some sort of burglary or something. Mm. And so they searched my whole car and they had me in handcuffs outside of the car.
Whoa.
Yeah. They thought I was, and then they like got a call or something and they were like, just kidding. I don't know. I guess they, I don't know just what kidding. They thought I was doing, but they were like, actually, ma'am, you're free to go. I was like, what the fuck is going on? It was like 6 p.m. and I was leaving a coffee shop.
Yo, does anyone in this room have the Amber Alert notification still on their phone? The one that's horrible and terrifying?
Wait, you can take it off?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah, it's the worst ringtone I've... every time I wake up, I'm like, oh, it's a tornado that has... It's Sharknado, you know, like, it's so fucking bad. I just like... Probably is an Amber Alert. You look like a... I mean, no offense, but yeah, you could kidnap.
I would kidnap a kid. Yeah. It must have been a kid thing.
Yeah.
I definitely... It had to be, like, kid-related, because I don't... No one looks like me and robs a bank.
So the moral of the story is, except in Ocean's 8.
Yeah, that's true.
The moral of the story
is... Thank you. They're very thin. So when you wrote the... the predictive policing thing, it started off with the Sandy Hook that was the intro. Do you think that was... More, do you think writing about that was more healing, or what is it, like, re-traumatizing for you?
Well, for me, I didn't write that in the first draft.
Oh, okay.
Because I wasn't used to writing about myself. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, the editor I was working with, who was fantastic, just said, you need to put yourself in this. You know, she deals with a lot of journalists.
What publication was this?
Eon Magazine.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and she was saying, you know, you have to put yourself in this. Yeah. So I try to think of a few different things, but that was the main one.
Yeah.
Because that one devastated me. Mm-hmm. I mean, as a Canadian, Leonard Cohen's playing, and, you know, there's a five-year-old. Because I was thinking about all those kids mm-hmm. and all those parents and all those lives that will never be the same. And it just kind of hit me at that last funeral I was covering.
And all those parents who will be harassed by Alex Jones fans.
That's horrific, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I had a friend who did a photo essay, and the headline was just like, I was there covering it, fuck off Alex Jones. You know, it's like the most read on Narratively. And because, that guy is selling a product, but he's also mentally ill, obviously.
Right. Oh, yeah,
he's out there. There's ideas.
Do you think
I don't think he has anything, any like thing that's diagnosable via like the DSM. I just think his blood pressure is so high that blood vessels in his brains have exploded. Like, I think he's had 100 strokes.
Yeah, and the DMT dreams that they're saying that he has.
Oh, does he fuck naturally? With DMT? Well, dude, apparently, speaking of ayahuasca. Yeah, keep going.
Yeah, no, apparently from what I heard through a source is that he... He's got something with the DMT. He's got a source with DMT, and he takes it every night. So.
Damn, DMT is for bad alt-right people.
DMT is the active ingredient in ayahuasca.
You what?
It could be.
Yeah. Well, I like am obsessed with DMT because it's one of those drugs that I will never, ever, ever, ever take.
Oh, I would never do it.
I have
absolutely as soon as I can. I would.
As soon as I get married, I'll do it.
I'll put you guys in touch.
Yeah, I can't have a psychotic break before my wedding. My mom would be so mad.
But it would be pretty funny.
Yeah.
You have the lungs for it. I understand. No, because according to Terrence McKenna, you have to have like real leather.
And Shane Moss, if you know. Have you come across Shane Moss?
Oh, I've heard about him.
Dude, you should look into Shane Moss. He has really, really good psychedelic stories.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, he just did a documentary on it, and he was doing a sort of science comedy, like, talk tour, I guess, about it, and it was really good.
And what's his deal, Shane Moss?
Well, basically, he's a comic, and he had done acid and mushrooms before, and gotten good things out of it. But then he sort of really, really got into DMT, and had this sort of ongoing journey narrative,
ongoing romantic relationship with someone he encountered on his trips.
Well. That's a part of it.
Yeah.
Basically, he keeps meeting these same like beings, mm-hmm. I guess you would call it
machine elves, as Terrence McKenna calls them.
in the DMT realm, but also he's very interested in evolutionary biology, so he's skeptical.
He's such a perfect
what he's finding throughout this whole process, and eventually I think he did kind of have a breakdown and had to stop, but he recorded himself going through DMT trips a few times.
And what kind of DMT?
He was smoking it, and then eventually I think figured out a way to vape it too.
What?
And he
sounds healthy.
Throughout this too, he
DMT light.
He figured out how to get, I guess, into the DMT mindset by taking mushrooms and going into float tanks. But at no point did he go Rogan.
I was about to say that's Joe Rogan shit.
I was gonna say, yeah.
What are you looking up?
I'm just looking. There's a podcast that is 4 hours long, and it is fucking riveting. And it's basically
don't play a podcast.
No,
I'm not trying. Yeah, that was an accident. But there's a podcast that's 4 hours long, and it's fucking riveting. And it's basically Shane Moss trip sitting the podcast host through a DMT trip, and then he does DMT, and the podcast host sits and bears witness.
Holy crap!
Yeah, it is, because you're totally. It's a really weird thing where you're still able to communicate and see the room, but you're so not there at all, and so you're he's kind of reporting what he sees.
Wow!
So it's called, let's see. Me and Paranormal You is the name of the podcast, and the episode is Experience 53 DMT Couch Sessions with Shane Moss, Part 1.
I'll definitely listen to that.
Yeah.
Can I ask your personal... You don't have to answer, but what your personal... Okay.
No, just kidding.
Yeah. What your personal relationship with psychedelics?
Psychedelics, MDMA, is...
I tried ecstasy when I was 18, and I had a girlfriend then. And I was at her house, and we were watching Varsity Blues. And at one point, I felt compelled to stand up and continue saying, "I don't want your life." And I was saying it so loudly that her father, who was a lieutenant.
Awesome.
With a big mustache.
Wait,
6'5".
What branch?
The NYPD.
Okay. You didn't even have to tell me that he was 6'5". I knew he was 6'5".
He's a big bastard. Yeah, he wasn't
He was either 6'5 or 5'6". Those are the only possible. Yeah,
those are the two cop heights.
Yeah, exactly.
So he storms down the stairs, and he's like, "What's all this noise down here?" So I sit down. I'm petrified. And she's like, "Oh, go upstairs. You're not intimidating, Dad." He's only 6'5", mustache, cop. He's like, "What do you want me to do? Come down here with a bat?" And then I died. And I just... after that, I just thought, I don't need ecstasy in my life.
Yeah, that's true.
So that was my first
trip. How did you feel, though? Was it amazing?
It was amazing up until that point.
Up until mustache.
I blame Varsity Blues, but I felt really good. I was chewing on candy. I felt my senses were heightened.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I felt
you're sucking
fantastic.
On a Jolly Rancher. That was a different era. Gummy bears. Oh, okay. Yeah.
It was great until that point.
And what about psilocybin? Never, yeah.
Yeah, I've tried mushrooms a couple of times. I tried mushrooms at Bonnaroo a long time ago to see Radiohead. And that turned into a psychedelic adventure.
Yeah.
That sounds fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was with my friend Jerry, and we sort of got lost. And for some reason, I had the Hunter Thompson thing where I was like, I got a recorder, goddammit, we'll be fine. Yeah. I had no idea where we were going. And we finally wrapped around, and we could hear some of the music. And I sat down on a towel, and I thought, finally. Peace. And then I felt like I was rising. Mm-hmm. And then I just surrendered to it, and it was fantastic.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Man, I want to do drugs now.
So what is your, what's the thing you were talking about, feeling compelled to pursue particular stories and beats? Like what is your personal connection to the MDMA PTSD or the MAPS thing?
Well, I think the PTSD, just in general, I'm interested in people who are able to overcome trauma and overcome all the bad elements of their life, depression, anxiety, that sort of thing. Just because I know a lot of people who went through it, and I love seeing a sort of comeback story.
With Katrina or in general?
No, just in general, people I know. Because I grew up in a really rough neighborhood in Queens, and I saw a lot of my friends either, overdose, get shot, go to jail, and the repercussions of that sort of ripple out. So you see their families, at the store, even as a kid, And you just, as an empathetic person, I could just see it in their faces and feel it. And just to see people like Lori Tipton go through that sort of thing and be able to come out the other end, to me, is just, it restores my faith in humanity. Whereas as a crime writer at Daily Newspapers, kind of made me lose faith in it.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, I think that's what's more compelling to me right now, as opposed to just a darkness, you know, of society. Because I think it's easy to go down that route with Trump and all the other bullshit going on. I think it's harder to be optimistic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's definitely a part of me that is still kind of attached to the, I guess, very like 1960s idea that part of a political revolution changing the world at all, these drugs could play a role in that. And I guess I think there are people who've had very serious specific trauma, and like the most important thing for those people is being able to function and heal.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like there's also potential for this to be a unifying experience for people to kind of understand that we're at a crisis point with the existence of our species any longer.
Yeah.
And it's strange to me that it's not more part of the left discourse.
I wonder if there's been any studies on like diagnosed sociopaths doing stuff like MDMA, in getting that sort of empathy part of the brain rolling or whatever. Like, I mean, not that everyone who isn't like agitating about climate change is a sociopath, but just like I see what you mean about like the sort of empathetic potential and the like revolutionary potential of.
I mean, I think if someone like Tucker Max can go from like
yes, totally,
honestly, like putting out like garbage that
vile,
realistically, yeah. like probably got people assaulted,
mm-hmm.
like out into the world, and like you know, I don't know the extent to which he's changed his thinking mm-hmm. on this, but I mean, if it's moving in the right direction at all, like if that can happen with someone like that, I feel like these things can get someone from just sort of like relatively apathetic or like disenchanted from the political process and like from their like fellow human being
yeah.
to like maybe trying to fix this before we all die.
Yeah.
Yeah. Amen. Yeah.
By the way, watch out for Tucker Max's next book. I hope they serve Molly at the Kava bar.
Have you tried ayahuasca?
I haven't.
You're a shit guy. That's perfect for you.
I am. I'd just shit and probably not. No, I'm sure I'd vomit too. I haven't tried it. When I was living in Hawaii, there were definitely what seemed to me like cults, I guess,
yeah.
that were doing it. And I guess that's all relative. I just saw Midsommar, so now I'm like very, you know, weary of that.
I hear you, man.
But I don't know. I'm skeptical of the structured nature of it without any sort of rigorous scientific background to it.
Yeah, sure.
But I don't know. I have a weird conflict with it where I think that like set and setting are important and people should be doing these things in responsible ways. Like I think they can be fun too. Like I'm yeah. not against people just recreationally, you know,
I mean,
doing them.
The practice of curating set and setting is a form of ritualization of psychedelic use.
But I'm skeptical of, I guess, the way I think about like ayahuasca retreats and like ayahuasca experiences where there are sort of self-appointed people at the head of this.
It's becoming commercialized and
oh, and you yeah, know that like sure. Silicon Valley douchebags are getting fleeced. Like, do you know what I mean? Yes.
I mean, yeah, there's
that. The Tim Ferriss crew and all that. Yeah.
But I feel like even if it's not commercialized and even when it is done in like more traditional settings, mm-hmm. I think those structures are still problematic.
Problematic in what way?
I get a self-appointed
hierarchy.
Hierarchies, yeah.
Well, wait. So tell me, I don't know about those structures. Is it a hierarchy, or is it just someone who knows what he's doing more, or what she's doing more than other?
Yeah, people? I thought it was just like a trip sitter in a hut.
I mean, ideally, I think it's that.
Yeah.
But you're put in such a vulnerable state that, like, I don't know. It would take a lot of trust for me to give someone else the power in that.
Right.
Dynamic.
Let someone trips at you for money seems weird.
Have you?
But even if you're
saying, witnessed any of these?
Yeah. Like I said, I was just in Peru. I'm writing a story about that. Yeah. I mean, it's powerful. I mean, I don't want to talk too much about it until the story comes out. But I was there for about a week at this retreat that was legit, and there was 8 of us. And yeah, I mean, it seems like before and after. We're polar opposites. I mean, these are people, veterans of trauma who...
were you taking part, or were you just...
I was observing, and then I actually tried it myself. Mm-hmm. Just to understand what it was to write about it, because I felt like I couldn't write about it unless
Without
I did it.
Yeah.
Because I also didn't want to be on the sidelines the whole time when these people are going through these traumatic situations. And it's powerful, man. I mean, it's the most powerful thing I've ever... ingested, for sure, but also some of the things I saw were unbelievably just sort of cataclysmic in terms of what was happening with these people. I mean, you saw the shift within days. I mean, and these are people who went through the worst traumas you can imagine.
What traumas? Or is it all different?
All different.
Missed from peeing. Sorry.
These are people in the military.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry. Yeah. And these are high level. Like I said, I don't want to talk too much about it, but Purple Heart recipients and, you know, these types of people who went through it. And this is the only thing to help them. They tried prolonged exposure therapy, SSRIs, cognitive therapy, speech therapy, everything. Yeah. And the fact that this isn't even the conversation and it's shut down because it seems like a psychedelic, like you were talking about Timothy Leary, and that sort of stigma that's been around since the 1960s, it's just sad to me.
Yeah.
That we haven't moved beyond that as a country is sort of pathetic.
Yeah. And also, I think that stigma was... I don't actually know nothing about Timothy Leary. I guess I should have considered to maybe look that up. Like, I only know his name is like Drug Man. And I've told you this before. I don't know anything about any of these people. but I just like drugs myself. And I've like seen them help people, but I don't know anything about the whole 60s thing. But it's stigmatized because it was definitely, I mean, it was stigmatized because it was counter to the political agenda at the time. Like, or was it actually bad?
I mean, I think there's definitely like been harm done by these things. I think it'd be irresponsible to say that there hasn't, but I think the stigma attached to it is pretty intentionally there because of the transformative power that it has.
Yeah, that's what it seems like.
Pharmaceutical companies will lose out if these things are more in the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
Pharmaceutical companies
because you need less of it. I mean, that's what
you need less of it.
Yeah,
I mean, you could just take it once or twice and you're good,
right?
You know, and that's a loss of business.
And the idea that it's addictive, I'm like, people who are addicted to it are already addicted to it, and also people who are addicted to it are usually doing it as a substitute for something more addictive that they can't get,
like kratom, even.
Yeah, exactly.
You're talking about MDMA still.
MDMA, yeah, and I mean, obviously psilocybin's not addictive.
You know what is addictive is fucking SSRIs and my antidepressant.
Yeah.
If I go off it, I'll fucking kill myself.
I mean, they're designed that way.
I you know, that sounds a little, that's more
tinfoil hat. That makes it sound sinister.
They're designed to be taken every day.
No, for sure. I mean, yeah, exactly. And like, I have just been peeing for about 5 minutes. It was a long pee, but
I'm getting inspired actually.
Just
you can pee whenever you want. It's all the way to the back of the house.
But yeah, just like the idea of like addiction potential as a metric for whether or not something should be outlawed is fucking hilarious.
Right.
Not just because of the way we prescribe opioids, but also like the entire antidepressant industry.
Mm-hmm. It has to be like addictive for it to work.
If you've ever known someone who tried to get off SSRIs, I think 30% of
I know
them.
Someone who's doing it now and just had to get back on.
Yeah, I mean, so, yeah, I mean, like, and like, there are people who, and I think there was another New York Times article about this, but New York Times Magazine article about this, but people will like take their meds with like this sort of like extended release SSRIs or whatever, and then count out the little like
the little balls in there and
wean themselves off, like titrate down like microscopically, because the withdrawal is so bad, and like, yeah. So who knows what you guys were talking about before this, but
no, pretty good looking to get you off were helpful. Or, yeah.
Yeah. No. Yeah. It was to in order to get off SSRIs because, you know, like for whatever reason, they can't have an orgasm or whatever. Right. You know?
He's
yeah.
not looking to get off them. He was You're just saying,
no, I'm on, them. I'm on some good stuff. That
he has a cap. He has a baseball cap for his SSRI.
I have a hat that it's not an SSRI, but I have a hat for my antidepressant. I like it so much. My girlfriend got it made for me because I stopped being an asshole.
Yeah, like, whatever works.
Yeah,
man.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah. But I mean, and so like I am like hella addicted to a
antidepressant
compound. Yeah. You know, so you know, fuck you if you think kratom should be illegal for, you know,
right,
because it's addictive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
because people who are going to get addicted to MDMA are not the people who are using it to overcome trauma, I would like to think, because those are people who are actively,
they take it like twice, they take it like
right,
three times,
exactly.
Yeah.
Those are people who are actively trying to overcome something, and I'm sure that if they are doing the work to do that, it means that they're too invested to fuck it up by getting addicted to something that like is largely something that, you know, I mean, I love MDMA, but it's largely something that, like, you do it. And as someone who's an idiot,
yeah,
and, like, loves to overdo things and has been a little addicted to a bunch of stuff, I mean, it's very hard to get addicted to because it's so strong. Yeah. And by the end of it, it's a bit of a trip.
Yeah.
So by the end of it, you're kind of like, all right, I'm going to ride out this sobriety for a bit because now I went, it's an experience. Yeah. It's not like cocaine,
yeah,
which is horrible and shouldn't be.
It's not
legal,
like a cocaine, which whips ass.
No, cocaine's horrible. Yeah. I don't do cocaine a lot, but like whenever I do, I'm like, man, this would be really easy to get addicted to because it's never that good.
Yeah.
But when it ends, it's so bad.
Yeah.
So that's what you get addicted to is the stuff that's like, ugh.
Yeah, Benjamin, we don't have to talk about this, and I'll cut it if you don't want to. But do you want to talk about your microdosing shrooms practice?
I mean, I haven't done it very like scientifically, mm-hmm, but sometimes I'll just take a very little nibble of shrooms in the morning and it seems to have like a definitely positive effect,
right,
on my day, which is, it's so weird that microdosing is like a tech bro like hyper capitalist thing that's starting to happen, that people are, I can't even imagine it getting into that mindset.
But I wouldn't let that... I mean, that's just because tech bros read a lot on the internet. It's not because it in and of itself is bad.
Yeah, it's not inherently like a pillar of capitalism.
It's just that they're
really into optimizing their lives.
It's their new kombucha.
Right.
Right. Which, exactly. And I love kombucha, but I used to make fun of it.
Yeah.
But like...
It's their theanine, and I love theanine.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. So, I mean, I wouldn't make that. It is weird, but also it's just because they're going to know about the cool stuff.
No one who has ever seen your beautiful face thinks that you are a tech bro. So
yeah, no.
Go on.
Oh yeah, I can barely use a computer.
Same. I can barely send an email.
But I don't. Yeah, I mean, like I've found that microdosing is like fun, and I'm like a slightly more alert and a little bit more positive throughout the day. But I've definitely had like way more profound experiences just tripping,
right,
which I've done probably several hundred times at this point.
Hmm. Have you ever taken too much by accident and gone to work, kind of thing?
Yeah, and it worked out great. I had a really good time at work.
In what way did it work out great?
I was just really happy to see everyone and doing...
Aww.
I was really enjoying steaming the milk as a barista.
Yeah.
You have a crappy job, but it's a good job.
No, it's a good job.
Yeah, it's a good job. Yeah,
absolutely. I like the people.
I mean, it's hard. It's like physically strenuous is why I said it's crappy, but it's a good job. He works at Pagoda.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Cool. Yeah, so come through. I'll make you some coffee.
They're very cool. Good.
Some roll you a taco or whatever. If you want.
So what did we forget to... I mean, I want to know more about...
Let me look through my notes. Keep going.
Yeah, I want to know more about like your background, even though I know we already covered it a little bit, but how long have you been a journalist?
Say about 15 years.
Okay.
Yeah, I kind of fell into it. I never took a class. I just got an internship out in Queens where I was living at age 18, maybe 19 in college,
mm-hmm,
and I fell in love with it.
Where'd you go? NYU?
NYU, yeah. Mm-hmm. But I was sort of misanthropic, but when I had to speak to people, I could do it, I found out. And that was helpful.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, I just would not. I would kind of shut down and just watch noir movies and read pulp novellas and listen to Tom Waits records, you know. It's kind of geeky, but I just really like being out there. And I always felt like I was getting away with something to get paid for the words.
Yeah.
When that's your currency, when you're paying your rent with words, it's just, even now, it's still a trip to me.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Mm. Counterpoint, I would rather die than have to pay my rent with writing. I like hate deadlines so much.
I hate them, but that's why they're helpful.
No. I hear what you're saying, and a lot of people, you know, like the sort of Douglas Adams idea of like, I love deadlines, I love the whizzing sound.
Oh no, I don't love them. I hate all of it. But
I have this you're not my dad reaction where it's like fuck you for putting me in a position where I'm obligated to do anything. I have like real oppositional. Me and Benjamin, I think that's one of the reasons why we get along.
I don't want your life.
No. Yeah.
Varsity Blues, bring it back.
Strong callback. Yeah.
You could edit that out.
Do you have anything that you want to? I think the last question that I want to start asking guests is like, what are you excited about in terms of your journalism? And like what is the thing that you spend the most time thinking about right now?
In journalism or just in life?
How about either? Yeah. No, I mean seriously.
What do you want to talk about?
What do you give a shit about and want to talk about on a microphone?
I feel like there's too many things. I feel like I could talk about hip hop. I mean, Rakim played live in New Orleans last night and I missed it and it feels tragic because he's my favorite rapper of all time. I've seen him several times and to me there's no one better. I don't know if you guys
He was the first great in my opinion. He was the first great.
I don't think anyone's matched him since. I mean, I love contemporary stuff. I love Nas, you know, but yeah, come on.
I love that Nas is your contemporary.
I was just about to say.
Well, I'm 80 years old.
Notoriously current and cutting edge rapper Nas.
Nas, yeah. You hear of him?
What is his...
Wait, are we not in 1991?
I was about to say, it's his last record.
You really are. You're a Queens dude.
Yeah, I'm old school, man. Yeah. Queens. AOA. Yeah, it's all happening. All
right. Does anybody else have anything else that they want to... Do you want to plug any of shows? You too?
Go see Todd Barry.
Oh yeah. What about the this will be out before the benefit the fundraiser for Margie.
Oh yeah. Both of the shows that Paul and I do, Night Church at Sydney Saloon on Thursday nights at 8:30, and Local Uproar at the Always Lounge at 8:00 on Saturday nights are doing fundraisers for Margie Green's campaign for Commissioner of Agriculture and Forestry.
Margie Green.
If you listen to that episode, you know what we're talking about. If you haven't, go back and listen to that episode.
Vote green. That means both agriculture and marijuana.
Right, but she does not climate smoke weed. It's just marijuana. Because it's good for the economy.
That's correct.
But those are going to be on the 25th and 27th of July. So come out to those and give some money.
Mm-hmm. All right. And we'll be doing stand-up, all three of us probably, right?
Yep.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for coming on the show, Henrik.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's been great.
Thanks, dude.
Thank you. We love you, everyone. Love you too. <I'm Henrik. laughs>